Six Music. From 12:30, the Six Music Jukebox. Right now, it's a Six Music documentary.
We went in studio. Ken Nelson was there. Owen Bradley was there. And to be truthful with you, I don't think that they had ever heard Cliff play. Because Cliff was not on the dub that we sent to Nelson. And, oh, man, they loved it. So we got to doing this and doing that. And he did a little bit of Woman Love and all kind of stuff. And then they came up with Bebopalula. And then when he did Bebopalula, we did the Scream, see? And when we did the Scream, everybody just stopped dead. And Ken Nelson says, he said, hold it, what happened, boys? What'd y'all stop for? I don't think Cliff really liked that part about me screaming because, you know, Cliff was one of the best guitars in the world. I mean, a lot of people been influenced by him. He was a good guy, but he was strictly music. That's why he was so good.
Ken Nelson then had to come up with a follow-up single and an album's worth of songs. But it's possible that that first album, Blue Jean Bop, was a bit rushed. The mix of material was bizarre. Rock and roll belters like Blue Jean Bop and Who Slapped John jostled with traditional numbers such as Hoagy Carmichael's Up a Lazy River and an even more extraordinary Peg of My Heart.
Peg of my heart, I love you, don't let us part. I love you, dear little girl. Sweet little girl, well, since I heard your lilting laughter, it's your Irish heart.
I think he had no intellectual control over his repertoire or over his recording. I think he was a very simple man and just did what he was told. So, for instance, he would record a song like Peg of My Heart, which is just a sentimental frippery, really. But someone would have come up with that at the session, and so he said, I'll do it.
The rock and rollers were playing straight-ahead rock and roll. You know, Chuck Berry was doing what he did, and Jerry Lee Lewis around that time. Elvis kind of mixed it up. He'd do some old ballads with the rock and roll, you know. But I think with Gene, first couple of albums, I think he had a great producer, Ken Nelson. And I think he encouraged Gene to really mix the music up on the record. You know, you get a real fast bop, and then they'd, you know, do something like Over the Rainbow, or Now Is the Hour, or so, you know, some Peg of My Heart, really, like a tune that was like 30 years old or something, you know. So it was a real nice mixture.
Guitarist Albert Lee is a little more taken with Ken Nelson's mix of the old and new in Gene's albums. He clearly admires Gene's version of Over the Rainbow, and so too does Manchester Vincent fan Mark E. Smith, lead singer with The Fall.
They like anything ever by Gene Vincent. I know, I do. One of the few people I can say that about. I don't know. Got all sorts of LPs by him, you know. Party Time, and got his first LP, you know, that's good. And, I even like Somewhere Over the Rainbow by him. It's not the greatest song, is it? That's how good he was, I think. He could make crap like that sound good.
The dreams that you dare to dream really do come true.
I was at a party with my manager when I was on Atlantic Records as a solo act. And my manager introduced me to Judy Garland, and Judy and myself got talking, and then I asked her to dance. And while we were dancing, Judy said, you know, my favorite version of Over the Rainbow. And I thought, sure, she was going to say herself. I said, no, who? She said, Gene Vincent.
Tommy Fassenda. Tommy was one of the new set of blue caps recruited by Gene after several of the original members left to go back to their families. One was ace guitarist Cliff Gallup, who only played on 35 Gene Vincent tracks, but who impressed a future generation of guitar players, such as Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and former Pretenders guitarist Adam Seymour.
He did Bebopalula, they went on tour. He didn't like being away from home. He was already married and he was I think he was a little bit older than the rest of them too. And so he decided to jack it in fairly early on, which in these days and times when everybody wants to be famous and be in a band and they will not let go and all they want to do is promote themselves, is absolutely unthinkable now to think that some amazing guitar player would then go like, well, you know what, I think I'll just stay at home with the missus and I'll do something else rather than continually waving a flag. He's playing on, say, a track called Cruising, where he did this amazing, very technically adept, very fast part of soloing, which is kind of his trademark. But then he slips into this really angular, right across the beat, really interesting notes, and then he's back into this other thing. And this is all within the space. I mean, his solos he had to fit into like 15 seconds or something, because the records only lasted a minute and a half. So he's allotted time with small. But he went into many places in those things. I think that's why for guitar players he stands out, because he did turn some interesting corners within such severe limitations, really, because they were doing 12 bar rockabilly blues stuff.
On foreign tours, Gene usually played with a pickup band. But on an Australian tour in 1957, the Blue Caps made their only trip abroad. The tour was a huge success and a good time for Gene, particularly as his single, Lot of Loving, had hit the charts after a long line of failures that had followed Bebopalula. Gene's new friend, Eddie Cochran, was also on the tour.
Ooh, well, I gotta get with a record machine. When it comes to rockin', she's the queen. We love to dance on a Saturday night. All alone, I can hold her tight, but she lives on the 20th floor of town. The elevator's broken down, so I walk one.
Eddie Cochran was to become an important figure in Gene's life, just as Gene was destined to become an important figure in Eddie's death. Few will deny they were close friends, perhaps because they seemed to complement each other. Eddie was open, warm and friendly. Gene was often remote, moody, withdrawn. Ray McVeigh.
He wasn't a talker. Eddie Cochran could chat to the public and tell a lot of yarns and all. He wasn't a chat man. He said, now we're going to do like, well, I'm going to do whatever it was. Now we're going to do this, we're going to do that. That would be his limitations on the chat, you know. He just wanted to go on with his act and sort of get off, you know.
The friendship between the two was set in vinyl when Eddie sang bass alongside Paul Peake and Tommy Fassenda on a session that was to become Gene's fourth album, a Gene Vincent record date. No one told Liberty Records, nor Eddie's manager, Jerry Capehart. Tommy Fassenda.
Eddie was an honorary Blue Cap. Eddie said, y'all need a bass voice on this song. I said, well, you know, Eddie, we don't have one. He said, I'll do it if you won't tell Liberty Records or Jerry Capehart. I said, good. Get it. It was the name of the song. Paul sang tenor, I sang lead, and Eddie sang bass.
Well, oh, well, oh, up, whip, whip, whip. Well, oh, well, oh, up, whip, whip, whip.
Well, oh, well, oh, up, whip, whip, whip. Well, oh, well, oh, up, whip, whip, whip. Well, oh, well, oh, up, whip, whip, whip. Well, oh, well, oh, up, whip, whip, whip.
In the early years of his success, Gene would often be drowned out by the screaming of young girls. But as time went on, all that changed. Ray McVeigh.
He was great lots of times. And lots of times, I always felt a bit sad for him, you know, because he always seemed to have a few problems, you know, and all the girls in the theatre never screamed for him. They were screaming for Billy Fury. But all the guys in the audience, they all loved Gene Vincent. But the girls loved Billy Fury. He used to get upset about it, yeah.
It's a big, fat Saturday night, and everybody's got a date but me.
In 1960, Gene and Eddie embarked on a lengthy tour of the UK, a tour arranged by legendary promoter Larry Parnes. The American duo was accompanied by an army of backing musicians and support acts such as Billy Fury, Joe Brown, Georgie Fame and Vince Eager. At this point in their career, neither Gene or Eddie were big stars in America, pushed aside by squeaky clean teen idols like Fabian or Bobby V. This is Tony Mea, who as one of the Shadows toured the United States in 1960.
We went to America in a very diffident way. We wanted to show them that we could play and we were good, you know, we felt we were good and as good as them. But I think rock and roll had changed a great deal from the time of its innovation, which we sort of followed with the Jerry Lee Lewis's and the Gene Vincents. I mean, most of the people we met in 1960 had never heard of Gene Vincent or Eddie Cochran. Can you imagine that?
He did have a few hits in America, but America tends to forget very quickly. The other examples are Buddy Holly and Eddie Cochran, Gene's great friend. Over here, they were revered, and after their death, they were, if anything, more successful than when they were alive. In America, they just move on. So by the time he came over here in 1960, he was a fading pop star.
Biographer John Collis and former Shadow Tony Meehan. A play called Bebopalula was revived in Los Angeles. Written by Rex Weiner, it was originally produced in 1991 by Adam Ant, Doors drummer John Densmore, and Johnny Depp's wife Laurie. It explored the relationship between Cochran and Vincent during that tragic tour in which Eddie was supposed to have had a premonition of his impending death. Here's an extract performed especially for this program by Aaron Dupree as Gene and Chance Dean as Eddie.
Lay that pistol down, baby, lay that pistol down. Pistol back in mama, lay that pistol down.
Pretty good for a couple of washed up failures.
Now don't joke about it, man.
It was just a joke.
Well, I wasn't joking, okay?
Touchy.
You know, what's so funny about it, huh? We are failures, you and me, flopperoo.
For crying out loud,
you
Gene.
You brought it up.
Yeah, I'm real sorry I did, too.
When was the last time you had a top 10 hit?
Last year.
English top 10 don't count. I'm talking about top 10 back home.
Okay. Summertime blues.
I'd like to help you, son, but you're too young to vote.
You know when that was?
August 1958.
2 years ago.
So what?
So my last hit was 1956. Man, I'm telling you, Eddie, time has passed us by. We're like the last desperados.
Now there are three steps to heaven.
It'll all be over soon. I hear thunder. Rain's gonna fall.
Man, it's always raining over here. If you thought it was all over, man, I mean, if you thought it was going to end tomorrow, how could you go on?
Well, now that's just it, ain't it?
Yeah, I guess.
Sure could use those pills.
You hear that?
Hear what?
Nothing.
No one will ever know whether Eddie Cochran did have a premonition of his own death. But late on April the 16th, 1960, the Ford Consul he was travelling in with his girlfriend Sharon Sheely and Gene Vincent hit a lamppost on the A4 near Chippenham. Homesick, Eddie and Gene were going back to the States for a break before rejoining the tour at the end of the month. Ray McVeigh remembers an unusual and rarely heard twist in an often told tale.
Usually I should jump in the car with the guys, you know, and I did jump in the car with the guys. But all of a sudden, Eddie Cochran had a problem because he wanted to take his amp back. He was going to leave it, but he decided to take it back, you know, because it was playing up. They wanted to take it back. So the driver says, okay, go and get the amp, man. So he came out with this, you've got to bear in mind, the amps were quite big. Not tiny things like now, you know, like big things. They came out, they're struggling out with this big amp. And this kind of driver said, oh, my God, you know. So it wasn't a problem. And I said, look, I said, I'll just go along with the boys in the van. So I get out and he got his amp in, off they went. And the next thing is, when we were driving along with the van, coming up, it was outside Chippenham. And the roads in those days were so bad, you know. There's no lights on the roads in those days. Now you've got street lights and street lights and street lights and nothing like that in those days. And Next thing is, we were driving on the scene. There was an ambulance there, and there was a police cars were there, and sort of, and we thought it was an accident, and then we realised it was the car. We were all cut up. You've got to bear in mind, we were all sort of youngsters. We didn't know what to do. I couldn't get the guys together. We were all drifting, and I went down to the hospital, and to see them, and I spoke to one of the nurses there and the doctors, and the doctor says, Gene Vincent will probably be all right. He says, but the other guy, what's his name? Mr. Cochrane. I said, Eddie Cochrane. He says, he's pretty bad. And he says, and I mean pretty bad, you know. So from then onwards, I was ringing and trying to find out what was going on. And I heard someone sort of say, if he had lived, he would never be the same again, because he smashed his head all open at the back and it's sort of just a mess, you know.
Tina Craddock recalls a strange event back home.
We heard when the hospital called and said that Gene was dead. Three times we were called saying that Gene was dead. And then later on that night, you can imagine Mom and Dad, they were just terribly upset. Gene called and said, you know, he was fine, he was out of it. Him and Eddie were sitting there having a cigarette. Gene didn't realize it. Eddie was dead, because he thought the guy in the next bed was Eddie.
Well, I'm going home to see my baby. Yeah, I'm going home to see my girl.
Gene returned to the UK tour, but then flew back to the States after receiving a mysterious telegram saying that his daughter Melody, by partner Darlene Hicks, had died. It was not true. Did Gene send the telegram to get out of the Eddie Cochran tribute show that Larry Parnes had booked him on? We'll never know. But one thing is certain, Gene began to act even more erratically as he began to drink more. He was now based in the UK, managed by the infamous Don Arden, touring and recording with the backing band Sounds Incorporated. I'm going home from the 1961 recording dates at the Abbey Road Studios. There was to be only one final session for Capitol the following year. In fact, the 60s was generally not a good time for Gene or his music. He toured with various bands throughout Britain and Europe, but the Beatles and all of us lot like The Who, The Kinks and The Rolling Stones had pushed to one side what was now an old-fashioned kind of pop. He did make some recordings on Columbia, with John Peel's label Dandelion, and with Karma Sutra, but there were no more hits. His leg was deteriorating badly. In more and more pain, he drank endlessly, pulled knives, picked fights. His relationship with Darlene foundered, and his marriage to Margie was short-lived. Their daughter Sherry recalls her one and only meeting with her father 10 days before his death.
Looking back over my life.
My mother told me we were going to see him that evening, so on my return from school, I got all dressed up in my party gear, and we got a taxi to Ealing Common. We were living in Chiswick at the time, so it wasn't far up the road. Yes, I know that I'll never make the same mistake again. He asked me if I'd like to walk around the garden with him. So my father and I entered this garden of this hotel, and it was a rose garden. And he held my hand and we walked around, and he asked me about school and my friends and, you know, various things like that. And we just sort of did basic chit-chat. And then there was a bench in the garden, and we sat on this bench. And I sat on his lap. And that's when he said to me that he was sorry for not being the father that he should have been, and that he'd often thought about me, but it was all going to be different now, and he was going to keep in touch, and he was going to have me come over to America, and he'd be coming over to England a lot more. And we kind of almost like made a promise to each other to renew this relationship of father-daughter. And I suppose now on reflection, I wonder if perhaps he knew that he was near to death, and it was the, you know, words of a man who kind of was perhaps at the end of his life and full of regret, really.
I've caught you some strife, but you know, oh, but you know,
that I'll never make this same mistake again.
In 1969, the BBC made a documentary on Gene, following him around England on tour. The support band was the Wild Angels, and Mal Grey was the vocalist.
There's a lot of stuff on film that never got showed for various different reasons, quite a political and quite a violent backstage tour. Gene was the one with getting the dirty end of the stick all the time. They showed Gene on stage a couple of times, and they showed his embarrassment at having no money and being robbed of sandwiches even. There was one incident when the penny started to drop. We were all sitting around a table, including Henry Hemroyd, who was the tour manager, Arden's couple of heavyweights, and we all got up to go upstairs for one reason or another. It's all being filmed. And we're three or four, five steps away from the table, and I would always let Gene go in front of me because that's how I felt. And Henry turned around to Gene and said, "Oh, Gene, pick that bottle up, we'll take it upstairs." So then you've got a picture of Gene on a boat, on a ferry, walking four or five steps towards a table to grab a half-empty bottle of wine and carry it up the stairs, all being filmed. And the penny started to drop that these people were just setting the guy up left, right and centre for whatever reasons I was unaware of at the time.
Some of the last recordings Gene made before his death from a burst ulcer on the 12th of October 1971 were produced by Rockin' Ronnie Wiser. He had to track Gene down.
If you should ever change your mind.
I'm at Aaron's record shop, and the owner, Manny Aaron, I asked him, "Do you know what happened to this guy, Gene Vincent? I mean, do you have any record by Gene Vincent?" Nobody knows anything about him. So Manny, the owner, says, "Look, Gene Vincent lives right here in Hollywood." When I go home, I try telephone information for Gene Vincent, nothing. So I try Eugene Craddock. And sure enough, Eugene Craddock lived on Fuller Avenue, which was only four or five blocks from my house, from my apartment. You know, I say, "My God, I gotta meet him. You know, I gotta go see Gene." So I drive over there, and as I'm driving over there, there's a little red convertible car coming with a guy that looks kind of familiar. I see his greasy curly hair all over the place, the wind from the car. So he parks the car. I go out of mine and I say, "Gene, my name is Ronnie Wiser, Hollywood Rock and Roll Fan Club. Could I ask you a few questions?" And he's very friendly. He says, "Yeah, come on over, come on over." So we go upstairs to his place, and he starts offering me sandwiches, soda pop, Coca-Cola, cookies, you know, potato chips, whatnot, and asking me about what classes do I take at UCLA, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking to myself, Jesus, I mean, here is this rock and roll legend, this incredible singer, Gene Vincent, and this guy's asking me questions. Yeah, I mean, this is like the Twilight Zone. He was releasing records on Kama Sutra and different labels, which were quite good, but something was still missing. The original soulful Capitol sound, the true thing. It's just like Little Richard on Specialty. You cannot touch that. He went to VJ Records later, and it was not the same thing. So I asked Gene if he were willing to record a few songs for his fans, and he said, "Okay." He comes over. And it's a small bedroom in Hollywood. My brother and myself shared it. And there is a small desk in front of a window. So there's a $145 or $48 Akai tape recorder and a $10 microphone on the desk. And there is Gene with his acoustic guitar. He chose The Rose of Love, the Little Richard song, "Hey, Hey, Hey," Sam Cooke, "Bring It On Home to Me," and Party Doll by Buddy Knox.
Well, everybody's gotta have a party doll to be with him when he's a feeling wild, to be ever on the true and fair, to run her fingers through his hair.
Some might say that Gene Vincent's career was over in 1960 when he stepped into that Ford Consul. Certainly, in his home country, he was a largely forgotten man, even if us Brits kept him going for another 10 years. But Gene's legacy is greater than that. For a start, he was one of the first on the scene. John Densmore, drummer with The Doors.
One of the original 50s rockers, along with a whole host, Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, etc., that planted the seeds of this devil music that's still going on, can't seem to stop it.
Gene's music and his image influenced so many of us in the 60s, and through our music, Gene Vincent lives. For John Lennon, the slapback echo and Gene's mean, quiff black leather look were part of his adolescence. Adam Seymour.
The influence that he had on John Lennon, right from the word go, from the Beatles, right up to John Lennon's last solo album, Just Like Starting Over, he's given it the full Gene treatment, and I think along the bin of time. It's, you know, he's still completely Gene Vincent.
Spencer Davis.
When you looked at Gene Vincent, you saw what influenced every Teddy Boy that came out of the UK. He was the inspiration. And if you look at some of the early haircuts that were sported by George Harrison, John Lennon, more Gene Vincent than Elvis Presley. But that presentation, which was a million miles from, say, Matt Monro, this was wild. And his use of the microphone probably influenced Rod Stewart, even Robert Plant. I mean, Robert Plant used to hurl the microphone around as well.
Jerry Lee Lewis.
He could take a game leg he had and sling it clean over the top of a microphone. I never seen anything like it. Wild as the West Texas wind. He'd give them a show.
The rockabilly crowd, of course, hails Gene as their hero. Lee Rocker of the Stray Cats.
Maybe this generation listening remembers the Sex Pistols. That's what Gene Vincent was at the time. Raw energy and passion and just this incredible feeling of breaking the mold of everything that came before it. Rockabilly music in general, and Gene Vincent in particular, that's the original punk rock. A hybrid, a blend of other things before it, of rhythm and blues and hillbilly music and their own thing thrown in there. The difference between punk music and rockabilly music is that you had like real players and singers doing it. It wasn't just abandon, you know, youthful abandon and energy. There was that, but there was a real background in musicianship.
He probably wasn't an easy man to love, but his sister Tina saw through to the tortured soul inside.
I would say he was the most unhappiest father, brother, son of any man or any woman I've ever known. He was a tortured soul. But he was beautiful. He could make you laugh so easy. And he could open his voice and he could sing and make you feel like, oh, you know, just for a minute, I'm there. It was amazing. Your poor heart will be broken, and your nights will be blue. Please don't laugh at my tears. It can happen to you.
For me, Roger Daltrey, goodbye. Oh, won't you were happy just for holding my hand. You told me that you love me. Now I cannot understand how you could leave me so lonely and blue. Please don't laugh at my teardrops. It can happen to you. Poor teardrops will find you. Just wait.
I always wished Gene well, and I still wish him well. I hope he made it to heaven.
Race with the Devil, the Gene Vincent story, was produced by Neil Rosser, and the Hollywood correspondent was Barbara Paskin. Please don't laugh at my teardrops. It can happen to you. Please don't laugh at my teardrops.
Six Music.
From Three, Six Music documentary. Right now, Late Night Jukebox.